I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. A week ahead of the April 15th tax filing deadline, we take a look at what could lead to a sea change in federal tax policy. Senator Ben Cardin has created a buzz by proposing a consumption tax, a tax on goods and services, or value-added tax, while also lowering business taxes and scrapping income taxes completely for lower and middle-income Americans. Should the U.S. adopt a tax on what you buy, not what you earn? Would that be more progressive than what we have now? We'll hear from Senator Cardin and from our panel, Michael Reich of the University of Maryland School of Social Work, Ken Solo of Pinnacle Advisory Wealth Managers, and Barbara Morgan, economist at Johns Hopkins University. First, the news. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us and making Midday part of your day. As usual, a two-hour show from now until 2 p.m. In the second hour of our show today, we're speaking with linguist Naomi Barron, who is on the faculty at American University. And she studies how we read and what we read, but also how we read, the intersection of technology and text. An overwhelming majority of men and women between 18 and 34 years of age, that's the millennials, still prefer to do serious reading on old-fashioned printed books. Can you believe that? The reason, Naomi Barron says, she believes printed books encourage deep reading and understanding of complex issues, while all those tablets and cell phones, electronic gadgets we use, are better for what she calls reading on the prowl. She'll be joining us in the second hour of our show today for a discussion about reading in this digital age. In this hour, we're 1 week away from the April 15th tax filing deadline, so we take a look at a new, and some would say, some have said, a radical proposal to do away with income taxes for millions of Americans and establish what is touted as a more progressive tax system. For years, many have argued that our federal tax policies are regressive, favoring the rich through loopholes, tax credits, and deductions. Maryland Senator Ben Cardin is working to reverse this with a proposal to implement a federal consumption or sales tax. The idea isn't exactly new. It's been around for decades, in fact, and it's been supported over the years by both Democrats and Republicans. The Washington Post noted that Senator Cardin's plan resembles another from the 1980s that was drafted by a Reagan administration advisor. Today, we want to spend a few minutes with Senator Cardin and ask him about his Progressive Consumption Tax Act. His plan would levy a tax on goods and services, like the value-added tax found in many other countries. Income taxes would be eliminated for households earning less than $100,000 per year. Did you hear me? Did you hear what I just said? And individuals earning under $50,000 a year, meaning most Americans would not have to file a tax return. Senator Cardin, welcome back to Midday.
Dan, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much.
So, Senator Cardin, what is a consumption tax, and what makes it progressive?
The progressive consumption tax has two absolutes, and that is that middle-income families will not pay any more taxes than they're paying today, low-income families the same. That makes it progressive, and it will be progressive. We do that by eliminating income taxes on families whose taxable income is below $100,000, and we give tax rebates for the consumption taxes based upon your income and your family size. It also will, the second absolute is that it will raise no more money than we say it's going to raise. You have what's known as a circuit breaker in here that will return to the taxpayers if the revenue projections exceed what we say it's going to be. The main reason for a progressive consumption tax is to be more pro-growth. It helps our economy grow. Today, the American tax structure is not competitive in the global competition. We have the highest marginal tax rates. We should have the lowest marginal tax rates since our economy depends less on the governmental sector than our competitors. So that's the main point of the progressive consumption tax. It's a much fairer tax. It's pro-growth. It's pro-savings. It's border adjusted for U.S. manufacturers and producers, so their taxes come off at the border. And it helps middle-income and low-income families.
When we say consumption tax, then a tax on goods and services, for businesses as well as individuals, a sales tax.
Right. It's a national consumption tax on all goods and services. It's at a 10% rate, so there would be a 10% tax. Remember, for low, middle-income working families, they'll get those taxes back through rebates, but it applies to all goods and services. The personal income tax would start at 15% for income over $100,000, and the maximum tax rate would be 28% for income over $500,000. The corporate tax would be reduced from 35% to 17%. So it reduces dramatically our income tax rates. It imposes a national consumption tax, but helps low-income and middle-income families.
It sounds like, especially when you get to those middle- and low-income families, a lot of Americans, maybe most Americans, would not have to file a April 15th tax return?
90% of Americans would not have to file an income tax return. And on the consumption rates, Americans who fall into that category of having a low amount of earned income would get rebates, so they would get the cash back before they make the purchases, so they would not pay the extra taxes.
I understand the principle of the idea of the cap that you have in there, the circuit breaker, but how do you know you'd have enough revenue to run the government?
Well, it's done after the fact, so that if we collect more revenue in year one, we rebate that revenue in year two.
Ah,
so
okay.
It does not affect the first year's revenue.
Have you gotten any political traction on this? I know you've gotten some props from media, from editorial writers who like this idea.
Yes, and we've gotten those who recognize that our tax code is badly broken. There really is no other alternative, I think, to fixing it. We tried to do that in 1986 by lowering the rates and spreading the tax burden, and we were not able to hold that beyond 1 year. So I think there's a great deal of support among those that recognize that the U.S. is in global competition, those who are looking for a fair tax code, those who are tired of trying to figure out all the intricacies of our income tax that has so many temporary provisions. And quite frankly, I hear often from neighbors who think they're not being treated the same as their neighbor who has the same income circumstance. So I think this is looked upon as a much fairer tax and one that could really help our economy grow.
Senator Cardin, thank you again for your time.
My pleasure. Good talking with you.
Bye-bye. So what do you think of that, our dear listeners? 410-662-8780 to join us with comments or questions in this hour of midday about Senator Cardin's Progressive Consumption Tax Act proposal. Long distance, toll-free, 866-661-9309 in the midday email address. For comments or questions, midday@wypr.org. Here to discuss and explain further Senator Cardin's plan, our midday contributors who join us from time to time to discuss issues of income inequality, Michael Reich, the Daniel Thurs Distinguished Professor of Social Justice at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, Ken Solo, founding partner of Pinnacle Advisory Group, the private wealth management firm based in Columbia, Maryland, and Barbara Morgan, senior lecturer in economics at the Johns Hopkins University. Barbara, Michael, Ken, nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Dan.
Pleasure to be here.
So, where do we begin with this? Ken, maybe we'll fill in some of the blanks here. This seems pretty simple on its face. When you get into the details, it does get complex. I think the idea here, one of the ideas, is to simplify things now. So what do you think of this idea? I'll just start with you with that question.
Well, first of all, anything that disturbs conservatives and progressives at the same time, my initial reaction, it's got to be great. And this is doing that very well. It's notable that most of the developed world, the United States, is really the only developed country that doesn't have this type of a tax. For example, Australia, they call it a goods and services tax, a GST tax. But it's all the same. I'm a little concerned, though, because even in the interview with Mr. Cardin, you described it like a sales tax. It isn't. So if it's okay, I thought I'd give an example of how this would work.
You don't see it as a sales tax.
Well, it's similar, but it's a supply chain tax. So what happens is, let's use an example here of a baker and a supermarket and a farmer.
Okay.
The farmer is going to grow the wheat. He sells it to the baker for 20 cents. The value-added tax is 2 cents at 10%. So the baker pays the farmer 22 cents, and the farmer sends 2 cents of the VAT to the government. Okay, now the baker makes a loaf of bread. He sells it to the supermarket for 60 cents. The VAT is 6 cents. It's 10%.
The value-added tax.
The supermarket pays the baker 66 cents, of which 6 is the VAT. Okay, the baker sends the government 4 cents. He pays 6 cents in the VAT, but he gets a 2-cent credit because they already paid 2 cents along the way. Finally, we buy it, okay, at the supermarket. You pay $1.10. Okay, there's your 10%. All right, the store sends the government 4 cents total, the 10 cents it collected on the VAT, but the taxes are collected along the way.
Along the supply chain.
Along the supply chain. So when you go to buy something, it's not like you see a 10% item on the bottom. You don't see it. It's mm-hmm. just in the price.
Okay. So that's good, Ken. I appreciate that. Barbara Morgan, the phrase value-added tax, which is very common in Europe and more than 100 other countries, I think I understand a little better just from Ken's example how value is added along the supply chain. Is that right?
Yes, I would agree with Ken's example. And I think one of the points to make, though, is that effectively consumers will be paying a higher price. They'll be paying 10% tax, okay?
Right.
And even though, I mean, there's many proposals out there similar to the one of Ben Cardin's, a lot of them, however, do not have the progressive elements built into them. And from an economic perspective, a consumption tax is actually quite regressive, okay? It's a tax on goods and services, and low and middle income folks in general spend a greater proportion of their income on necessities. So, for example, a family with $50,000 in income, most of that probably goes on food, utilities, healthcare.
Rent.
So they
mortgage.
Are mm-hmm. taxed at 10%. But mm-hmm. a family at the other end of the extreme with $500,000 in income may only spend 75% of it. Okay, so they're taxed at 7.5%.
You mean currently? You're talking about the current system? Or you're under this new
system?
Any
consumption tax is regressive. Ben Cardin's proposal has progressive elements built into it. But there's a lot of consumption tax proposals out there, and a lot of them do not have those progressive elements.
Okay. I'm not sure I follow what you said about the difference between a higher income family and a lower income family when it comes to consumption tax, sales tax.
Low and middle income families tend to spend a greater proportion of their income, right?
Right.
If you're a family with $50,000, you're probably going to spend it all, right? So you pay a 10% tax rate. If you're a family with $500,000 income, you probably don't spend it all. And so you're only paying tax on, let's say, $375,000 of your spending power, so it's a 7.5% tax. It's
okay.
a regressive
tax.
Okay,
so my but for you then is the family at the lower end of that scale mm-hmm. is not paying income tax.
Well, as I said, there are progressive elements in Ben Cardin's proposal. There are many other proposals out there of a similar nature that do not have the progressive elements built into them.
Okay.
And so we have to be very careful because, in its essence, a spending tax is regressive.
See, that's what I wanted to get at today. And Michael Reich, I'll direct this to you. We always talk about sales taxes as being regressive, right? That term is used frequently with sales tax.
Right.
And I think of it as in combination with income taxes. So if you eliminate income taxes for, in this case, millions of Americans, households of income $100,000 per year or less, then isn't sales tax less regressive, as Barbara says?
Well, Barbara is correct if this proposal is implemented as it's currently drafted. But I think you have to put things in a wider context. First of all, the other nations to which we compare ourselves also have much more progressive social policies and social welfare systems. There's no guarantee in this, particularly with the so-called circuit breaker component, that we'll be spending sufficient funds to satisfy the needs of people the way in which Sweden, France, and other European nations do. Let me just throw out one statistic. The poverty rate in the United States is, before we take into account our current social policies and taxes, is actually lower than the poverty rate in France and Sweden if we didn't count their transfers and tax policies. After we take those into account, however, the poverty rate in Sweden drops from about 28% to 4%, in France from 31% to 7%, but in the United States it only drops from 26% to 17%. So there's no guarantee in Senator Cardin's proposal that we're going to have the other side of the equation, that we're going to spend enough money to create greater social equity in this country, particularly in light of all the fiscal cuts that have come down since, you know, the Great Recession started.
Let me just explain what Michael means there by the circuit breaker, because that's the term Senator Cardin used in the brief interview I just had with him. His proposal would require the return, that's why he used the word rebate, the return to taxpayers of any revenue this plan generates beyond 10% of gross domestic product. So basically a cap on federal spending, which I'm sure conservatives like in terms of this plan, Ken.
Right. I think that that's the beauty of this. So as we've heard already on the panel, progressives are very, very nervous about the regressivity. You know, will this $100,000 family credit offset the pain of having some type of a consumption tax? But conservatives are very worried because this is so simplified. It gets rid of all the deductions. It's trading in a beautiful way. It's trading lower rates for losing deductions. There's only three deductions in a tax return here. And so they're worried that this will be raising too much tax money. And that's why the circuit breaker is there, so that conservatives who are worried that tax revenues will go much higher, that's why it's in there.
Barbara Morgan.
Well, this reminds me of a comment Larry Summers once made when he was asked why the VAT does not exist in the United States. And he said the reason is it's because liberals think it's regressive and conservatives think it's a money machine for government, and we'll get a consumption tax when liberals and conservatives switch positions. And it's kind of like what's going on. We have a lot of proposals out there.
Yeah.
I'm not opposed. I'm skeptical. I think the devil is going to be in the details. And the a proposal very similar to this by Yale professor Michael Graetz, who I think is, Ken mentioned, this is a 12.5% rate. The Tax Policy Center did an analysis of that program, and it had many of the progressive elements that Ben Cardin has, and they concluded it's slightly regressive, okay? It's not progressive, it's slightly regressive. Hmm. And in the real world, if we look around the world, consumption taxes in general have been regressive, although in Europe, because of the factors that Michael mentioned, they have been mitigated, okay? I would be more likely to support it if first it's used as a supplement to the progressive income tax and not an alternative. And secondly, that the revenues from tax, as Michael mentioned, would be used for investments that help the middle class.
Okay? So you wouldn't eliminate income tax. You would want to have it.
Well, this doesn't eliminate income tax either.
No, but it eliminates income tax for, you know, quite a number of Americans, $100,000 households or less.
But again, I think we have to put this in the broader context. First of all, the political context. And we've seen in the past with other comprehensive legislation in which only half of the pie was actually baked. So, you know, for example, all kinds of welfare reform was been proposed for the last 25 years, or mental health reform, on the assumption that we would establish community services or government-funded jobs. Didn't happen. So all we got were the punitive elements. Secondly, we have to keep in mind that states often raise their revenues through sales and local taxes. This doesn't say anything about that. It poses it as a problem to be resolved. It also doesn't take into account the differential spending patterns of households. People in Baltimore, Washington area spend a lot more money than people in Mississippi, for example. And what about people who have excessive health care costs? Because those goods and services are also going to be taxed according to this proposal. And finally, just to get back to Ken's beautiful metaphor of the bread, there's more that goes into bread than flour. So those people are also paying for the cost of packaging and transportation and fuel to bake the bread and the equipment to bake it. So, you know, that makes this even more complicated.
We needed to take a break, but we'll come right back and talk some more about Senator Cardin's proposal, a progressive consumption tax, a value-added tax in place for many Americans of an income tax. What do you think of this? And if you have questions, this is a good time to give us a ring, 410-662-8780. We'll be right back. Though imperfect and unlikely to pass Congress anytime soon, Senator Cardin's plan deserves to be taken seriously by anyone searching for a way out of the blind alley that is the current partisan discussion of fiscal issues. The key concept of Mr. Cardin's proposal is a massive shift in taxation from household and corporate income to consumption, levied on all purchases of goods and services from the time they are created to the time they reach their end user. The consumption tax would be set at 10%. It resembles the value-added tax in the rest of the developed world. Mr. Cardin would offset its inherent regressivity by eliminating income taxation for all households earning less than $100,000 and individuals earning less than $50,000, with added rebates to assist families with very low income. The upper income minority would face three income tax rates, 15%, 25%, and as Senator Cardin said at the very top, 28%, and there would be four remaining deductions for them: charity, mortgage interest, state and local taxes, and health and retirement benefits. The corporate tax would drop to 17%. I'm just quoting there from a positive editorial in the Washington Post giving Senator Cardin props for bringing this up, even though currently this probably has no chance of passage, but it's something that needs to be discussed. And there's been a lot of press about the consumption tax just in the last couple of weeks, so we thought we'd talk about it today with Michael Reich from the University of Maryland School of Social Work, Barbara Morgan from Johns Hopkins University, and Ken Solo from Pinnacle Advisory Wealth Managers in Howard County. Ken, before we go to the phone lines, let's take some calls here. Senator Cardin said this is pro-growth. Do you see it as pro-growth? Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely.
How is it pro-growth?
So. Just because when you simplify taxes, when you lower the rates the way you do, it encourages risk-taking behavior. It encourages the types of things that we want. This plan throws the interest and our income on our savings into that $100,000 bucket. So folks who we'd love to incentivize to save and invest do get some incentives for that. And I think there's a lot of evidence globally where countries that have gone to a flatter tax have seen an increase. And I don't have that at my fingertips, but I think it's fair to say it would be pro-growth.
What about Michael's points about how true value added would not be regressive if the government provided services for people on the scale we see in other developed countries?
Yeah, I can only speak to the notion that we have to remember about 30% of Americans itemize their taxes. 70% don't even itemize. I don't know the exact number of how many are not paying, and I don't know the number of those who actually get rebates because of child tax credits. Mm-hmm. So we have a percent of population who are actually, I don't want to use the word making money for our poor, but this plan is giving them the same rebates. He's being very careful here to not disturb his base with how this is structured.
Here's an email to Michael's point made earlier, this one from Brian. A question: how is this equitable across the country when the cost of living varies so much throughout the country?
That's your point.
He says $100,000 threshold in this area is not hard to achieve for a family, meaning here in Maryland. Let's go to the phone lines and take some calls on this if you have questions about it. Jason in Baltimore, welcome to Midday. Go right ahead with your question.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just had a question about this consumption tax proposal. Does it have any triggers in it that would affect how household income is applied for, let's say, a married couple where one partner is making a significant amount of money, whereas the other partner, comparatively speaking, is not? Does that kind of trigger some, or is the definition of household income going to change at all?
I haven't spoken to a tax accountant, but I would assume that it would have no impact, that they would file as a household unless they chose to file separately, just as today.
Yep, I think that's right. Under Cardin's plan, the new tax would lead to the elimination of income tax on the first $100,000 in income for joint filers, or $50,000 for individual filers. And then, as I mentioned above that, you get to three marginal brackets, 15%, 25%. And 28%. Also, the corporate tax rate drops to 17%, roughly half of what it is now. Rick and Frederick, with your comment or question, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. I'm calling about the Hall-Rubushka tax proposal that's been around for some time. It's also a consumption tax, but to the most to the average user or, you know, taxpayer, it looks a lot like our present income tax, because they're taxed on their wage and income, but they're given a deduction for their investment. In effect, so the thing that they spend taxes on are the, are non-invested dollars or money that's spent. So it's a consumption tax. And then the same achievement can be made as far as progressivity by giving a huge deduction for, you know, families and people of low income. And so you end up simplifying our tax system. You don't have the administrative overhead of the value-added tax or a national sales tax would create, and you have the same progressivity that you could get with the proposals that Senator Cardin has. Anyone talk about that?
Yeah, but we're talking about Senator Cardin's proposal today, but right. I mean, as far as the flat tax goes...
I haven't seen the details of this, so I really can't comment on it.
I mean, flat tax has been proposed before.
It has some similarities to this consumption tax, but I want to go back to the point about growth, because every time these kind of proposals are presented... that this cuts taxes, you know, especially in high income, we're going to have these huge growth effects. There's no evidence of that. The CBO has predicted modest and uncertain effects from tax cuts. It's a very simplistic view that low tax rates, a supply side argument, inevitably lead to growth. Targeted tax cuts can promote investment in areas that societies think are valuable, so from environmental perspective or a distributional perspective, but the relation between overall tax cuts and growth, the balanced growth that benefits the middle class, is very tenuous.
Right.
We have natural experiments, big tax cuts in Louisiana and Kansas. That didn't work out very well for the middle class because unemployment rates are much higher and their growth rates lower. I have one more point to make, which is the demand side. This takes spending power away from low and middle income families by increasing prices. So I'd be concerned about the impact on aggregate demand, which also influences growth. In fact, United States economists are currently advising Japan not to raise their VAT because they have a growth problem. So it's a little bit of a stab in the dark with respect to the macroeconomic impact.
Well, can I ask Barbara a follow-up question? You know, we have a consumer economy here
led
in the
economy.
U.S., a consumer-led growth. When we think about growth, we think of, you know, consumerism as sales, right? So it would make some people nervous, I think right? Adding a consumption tax in terms of the U.S.'s stature as a consumer-led economy?
I think that's precisely the point I was trying to make. The supply side effects are not clear, and the demand side effects are worrisome.
Michael Reich.
I agree with Barbara. I also have a couple of other points. First, you know, this is kind of like the earned income tax credit, in which people get a rebate at the end of the tax year. But first of all, from an administrative standpoint, a lot of people who are eligible for that don't file. They don't know about it. They don't know how to do it. So we don't know if the people will actually get the rebates to which they're entitled. That's an implementation issue. But there's also what I would call a cash flow issue. People are going to be paying more, as Barbara pointed out, for goods and services on a regular basis, particularly in more expensive metropolitan areas. They're going to have to lay that money out and then wait till the end of the year to get a rebate. And that's going to make it more difficult for low-income and working-class families to support themselves in buying essential goods and services. The other issue about growth is, I would agree with Barbara for the most part, but in any case, growing aggregate GDP has never necessarily led to more equitable distribution of that GDP. So we see now that the GDP has grown, but we have a greater inequality, as we've discussed several times on this show. A couple of other points. If I understand Senator Cardin's proposal correctly, nonprofit organizations and the government will also have to pay the PCT, the Progressive Consumption Tax, on the goods and services that they purchase, which is not the case right now. How will this affect particularly small nonprofits who provide a lot of essential services on a shoestring budget? And how will it also affect government, which purchases a great deal of services from the private sector, as well as goods?
You know, I'm taking notes on your questions here. Senator Cardin is scheduled to be a guest on our show next week. I think it's Monday, right? Is he here? Is he Senator Cardin here on Monday? The 13th, right? From 12 to 1. If that's not the 13th. Yes, it is the 13th, because April 15th is Wednesday. So we'll get more on this from Senator Cardin. I'm making a note of your question here. Michael Reich for him on Monday. We'll take a phone call in just a minute. William says, I am concerned that this tax proposal seems indeed nice for middle-income Americans, but is actually more aggressive when you get to the lowest incomes. The lowest income Americans don't pay taxes already, such as those on disability, and therefore they only face increased costs at the grocery without any financial relief. Those with the lower incomes who do pay taxes and need the most relief actually save less than those who are middle income because they were paying less in taxes to begin with and are faced with increased consumption costs. This does not seem to help those most in need and, in fact, may hurt. So, yeah.
Well, I think we're going to get back to, Dan, we're just going to get back to whether or not you believe. We've had so many shows about income inequality, mm-hmm. and I'm so squarely in the camp of we either figure out how to grow this thing or we're not going to get out. You're not going to fix it through income redistribution. You have to get to growth. And this is so squarely in the growth camp that it's hard for me to accept the notion, even if the growth is slightly regressive, as Barber says, they can't score. And if you talk to the people who do score these things, it's very difficult to score economic growth from a change in taxes. And I just believe that the folks who are most in need will benefit from increased jobs, from just increased economic growth. I believe that.
You don't think you can change it just with changing taxation, giving the government more power, more revenue to do more with.
And I'm sure upset just about everyone as well. But honestly, I don't believe there is enough income to fund our government and the things we want to do. You're not going to be able to tax people enough. Eventually, you're going to have to tax consumption. It's the only way to generate the kind of revenues we're going to need over a long period of time.
We already tax consumption. We pay 6% on many goods in the state of Maryland, and there's a higher sales tax rate in other states.
No, I'm talking about federally. At the end of the day, you can't keep the pump running you can move the bracket from 50 to 60 to 70 to 80, whatever you want to tax your big earners. But there just isn't, I don't believe, over time, going to be enough money there to do the things we need to do.
But as we've said ad nauseum, perhaps, in past shows, when we've had higher tax rates and also had more redistributive tax policies, spending policies, social investment, we have produced the kind of growth that reduces the gap in income among the American people. And, you know, there's lots of evidence of that.
Yeah,
I think the same thing is
Michael
true today.
Michael has history on his side with that one, I think.
From my perspective, if I'm in the city or someplace, I'm unemployed, and I want to know what kind of changes are going to be game changers to change the paradigm. We've built this impossible tax code. It's impossibly complex. And for the people that pay the taxes, the huge percentage of people that pay accountants and so forth. By the way, we have a flat tax. I haven't mentioned it yet, but we have an alternative minimum tax that looks and smells much like this. The top bracket is the same. It's a slightly different exemption. You get mortgage interest deductions and charitable deductions.
Back to the unemployed guy on the street. So
yeah.
You're saying you're looking at, like, what's going to help me, right? And you're saying...
If you're going to just,
saying,
let's say we're going to go from a 52%, a 40% to a 46% top bracket,
right,
whatever.
Right.
I'm like, we've been up and down this road. Do something that's going to change the paradigm, that's going to really give us a shot to
Well, what
make
would
a
that
difference.
Be?
Exactly
so,
this.
You,
go to
you
a
think
consumption.
It's this.
Yes, I do.
I don't see how this would help that individual. I mean, what is the incentive within the consequences of this policy to raise wages, which is a particularly critical part, or to create jobs? In fact, it's possible that, you know, it might not necessarily create the kind of jobs that are going to enable people to afford the increased day-to-day cost of living that a regressively implemented consumption tax would produce. If we don't have the other side of the equation, as I said earlier, this is going to put a disproportionate burden on the people who are most in need.
Michael, what about the mass of people who would not be paying income tax anymore? They would have more disposable income, correct? I know they would be paying more because of the tax, but they would have more income at their disposal, less going to the government.
zero going to the government.
But we don't know, we haven't done the math yet on what this would do in terms of the overall cost of goods and services. So I think that there's a lot of unknowns in this, and that's why I said at the outset that I have many more questions than I do answers in this regard.
Dan, you might be interested. Our friends at the Pew Charitable Trust, they did a study. They defined middle-class households as earning 67% to 200% of a state's median income. In their study, guess which state has the highest? Maryland.
Maryland,
where the median household income is $72,000. And the middle class lower bound is 48,000 and the upper bound is 144. So a huge percentage of the middle class is no longer going to pay taxes.
We have to take a break. Ken, Barbara, and Michael will come back and talk some more and take some calls. 410-662-8780. This is the Midday Show, talking about Ben Cardin's proposal for a progressive consumption tax. Michael Reich from the University of Maryland School of Social Work, Barbara Morgan from Johns Hopkins University, and Ken Solo with Pinnacle Advisory in Columbia. A short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here with a question for Barbara Morgan, and we'll go to the phone lines and take some calls. Earlier, you cited a Tax Policy Center look at this proposal for a consumption tax. Now, Senator Cardin is proposing setting the tax at 10%. I think he acknowledged in an interview that that might have to be adjusted. But they that 12.9% you cited earlier, 12.5 or 12.9, what does that percentage represent in their survey of this?
Well, that was a they estimate that in order for this type of a program to be revenue neutral, that the tax, the consumption tax, would have to be 12.5%.
Revenue neutral meaning?
Meaning it has no budgetary implication. You're neither spending anymore, right?
Than you are
currently. Right.
So they now, need to be 12.9%. Okay.
12.5%.
12.5.
And that policy, that has various similar elements. The income elements are the same, and except the tax rate is slightly different. And the conclusion on income inequality, which I'm somewhat concerned about, is it was slightly regressive, not hugely regressive.
Okay. A question, a follow-up question for Barbara Morgan. We were talking before about the U.S.'s longstanding role as an engine of consumer-led growth, and I think Senator Cardin mentioned competitiveness, international competitiveness. So many other countries have a value-added tax. Talk about that for a minute. Does that give us any kind of edge, or does it bring us up to speed with other countries?
I want to talk about the other one, other element in Senator Cardin's, which was, is lowering the corporate tax rate to 17%.
Okay.
Currently, the statutory corporate tax rate, including state, is 39.1%, and the OECD weighted average is about 29%. Of course, the effective tax rate is much lower once you've got rid of exclusions, and it's around the OECD average. And so Cardin's wants 17%, Republicans want 25%, Obama wants 28%. 17% is pretty low, okay? There's only a few countries with a rate below that, including Ireland, which we cannot say has actually had a great history.
Right.
The other point I want to make is that we don't know if there'll be retaliation. And finally, competitiveness, we hear about competitiveness with respect to corporations, but it depends on a lot more than lower taxes. We need a competitive labor force, for example, a competitive infrastructure, a competitive investment in technology and energy. Those elements are also important in terms of our competitive edge.
Michael. I think Barbara raises some very good points, and it also leads to a broader, perhaps philosophical and political issue. For 35 years, we've been told that the country is better off if people are given control of their own money, as if their spending individually will somehow benefit the whole. But there are many aspects of expenditure, such as those that Barbara pointed out, in terms of social and physical infrastructure, that we can only have enough revenue for if people pool their resources and we spend it collectively through, you know, taxation and government. So while it may be true that one day of the year a family is better if it has a little bit more cash in its pocket, we as a society in the long term will not be better off if we don't invest in things like education, technology, research, physical infrastructure, healthcare, and so forth.
But Michael, this plan is revenue neutral, so we're starting from this. It's not.
But we're
not
spending enough right now, Ken.
Okay,
that's
but
the
question of where to invest is a different question. This is just about with this tax plan, would you somehow stimulate growth, simplify things for everyone, encourage people to invest, which is, of course, the holy grail of how you get jobs to the people who need them? And could you do that without, I mean, the reason there's a rebate in there for this percent of GDP is conservatives are worried it'll generate too much money. So I don't think that the question here is about, where to invest, whether it's education or infrastructure.
But you have to look at why are they concerned that it will spend too much money. Are they concerned because we might have more money to spend on the military? No, they've already proposed spending a higher proportion on the military. They're concerned because if people become less independent on the market, that will alter the power equation in our society and give the average person more leverage in daily and collective transactions than corporations, which are increasingly coming to dominate every aspect of our society and culture.
When we say progressive, some people hear, progressive meaning pro-growth, more money in the hands of people to make investments, right? More power over their own money, less taxes going to the government.
Right.
Some people hear progressive and say less of a burden on people of lower incomes until they can get more traction in life and get going and move up, have that social mobility that we talked about, right? That's how some people hear, when they hear progressive, that's what they think of, right?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. To me, without having the numbers fully crunched, and this is, Cardin put this out as talking points.
Right.
And for us to be talking about how you mix a consumption tax, whatever the details are, with income taxes where you have this huge offset for families under 100,000, and that's where we get started. Somewhere in there, I think, is a valuable solution. And the other thing is, we actually did a show about the problems with corporate taxation, where corporations being unfair, moving overseas, leaving money over there,
right.
Those inequalities in taxation between the other developed countries in the U.S. This 17% rate and those changes, whether it's 17 or 19, wherever, is going to take us to a really good place, I think, again, for growth.
Nathaniel in Bel Air. We'll go to Nathaniel with a call about small businesses. Hi, Nathaniel.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for taking my call. As a young person who's looking to start a business, I'm wondering what this kind of consumption tax would deal with a small business, especially one that's got to make a lot of raw purchases and is making a product.
Cardin admits that that's one of the issues to be resolved. In his position paper that he put out, Nathaniel, he says that it's not clear how it would treat certain industries and small businesses. So that would be something that would need to be discussed.
Dave in Lutherville with your question. Welcome to Midday.
Good afternoon, and thanks for taking that call. I'm generally a big fan of Senator Cardin's, and I've read a good deal about the fair tax, the flat tax. But it seems to me we're using some duct tape to take two very bad systems and join them together. The problem I'd like to focus on or ask a question about is the accounting. Isn't it going to require a bureaucracy even more convoluted and torturous to keep track of all of these value-added steps? In the very simplified example that one of your guests gave earlier, we had three steps in the production of a loaf of bread. Well, it's going to be six, seven, eight steps in the production. And isn't all that accounting going to be onerous and actually job-killing?
Okay.
Thanks. I'll take a call and my answer off the air.
Barbara, you want to take that one? Barbara Morgan?
Sure. I think that would definitely be something to talk about and to encourage debate about. I think folks are seizing on this ideal consumption tax. It's very appealing. It seems very simple. But in Europe, income tax systems are also very straightforward. You basically pay your taxes, few deductions, few exclusions. And so I wonder if the final version of the consumption tax will not be subject to the same pressures, to the mm-hmm. same compromises mm-hmm. as the income tax. There's many, many different versions of this.
Earl, just to the, I'm sorry, can I get some emails out right here?
Yeah. That's fine. Yeah. Just to the caller's question, developed countries all over the world do this accounting. It's done everywhere. I'm sure here in America we'll figure it out. It won't be the deal killer.
Yeah, this is one thing that Ken and I agree on. I mean, Australia.
We found one.
It only took about six shows. But the GST in Canada, Australia, and New Zealand is implemented pretty seamlessly. And Canada has a provincial system. Australia has a state system. And they also have state taxes there. And they found a way to incorporate that as well. So I think this is not the deal breaker. There are other issues that need to be resolved first.
Matthew in Hunt Valley, go right ahead with your comment. Welcome.
Hey, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I had just two examples I wanted to bring out because I haven't heard this question, at least for me, satisfactorily answered. If under the Cardin's program, there's going to be a tax based on consumption, and that's going to be at the consumer and the corporate level, which means that basically, at a minimum, the cost of goods and services are going to go up by 10% across the board. If you have a person now who makes $20,000 a year and they're paying $12,000, basically $1,000 a month in rent each year, and they're left with $8,000 and their cost of goods and services just went up, assuming that they're just spending the remaining and not buying on credit, they just lost $2,000. That means they've lost a quarter of their disposable income after they give themselves a place to live. So my question is, you know, on top of that, how is that program benefiting that person? They weren't paying income tax before, and now they have their disposable income cut by 25%.
Well, we do have, in this proposal, there are rebates to individuals and families who are low income. I'm not exactly sure what level the rebates are given, but...
Anyway, it's another question I'll save for Senator Cardin specifically on Monday. But generally speaking, some people in emails are questioning, you know, what this does to growth. How does this help growth? If I'm Catherine in Frederick says, if I know I'm going to pay 10% more for anything, I'm going to buy less. How does this help growth? Actually, I don't know. What do you buy less of? You still have to buy food. You still have to buy gasoline. You still have to buy those necessities of life.
Cardin points out that one of the issues that are not resolved yet is whether all sorts of services and all sorts of purchases would be subject to this tax. For example, he mentions large cash items like automobiles, and whether automobiles would be subject to this, because that would clearly, I think, you know, people are not going to stop buying groceries, but they may defer buying an automobile if there's another 10% added to it. And that would have a significant economic impact and a significant impact on employment as well.
Don writes in to say that countries with value-added taxes and GST taxes do not have sales taxes levied by localities and regional governments. If you buy goods or services anywhere other than in the U.S., you will pay national VAT, value-added tax, but no taxes collected at the cash register. This new plan will amount to double taxation as local and state governments will not give up sales tax revenue. That's from Don. And Earl says it's delusional if you think the corporations and the rich that run this country will ever allow any kind of national flat tax. The current tax system is designed for them to avoid any taxes. Why would they accept change? Well, we're not saying that they would, but there seems to be a lot of agreement in Washington on one thing, that the current system is broken and needs to be reformed in some way.
Just a quick point about the first email, and that is that in Canada, there are certain provinces that do have an additional sales tax added. I don't know about Australia, but I know that they do, and they fold it in to the cost of goods, so that they have done that.
Well, Michael Reich and Barbara Morgan, Ken Solo, I appreciate this conversation about this topic. Senator Cardin will be with us on Monday, so we can follow up with some more questions for him about this. I'm taking notes here. And to our listeners, if this intrigues you, if this piques your interest, please send us an email with a question and keep that in mind. Senator Cardin will be here live on the Monday show, Monday midday. Thank you very much. Ken Solo from Pinnacle Advisory, Barbara Morgan from Johns Hopkins, and Michael Reich from the University of Maryland School of Social Work. Thanks again for this conversation.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
Stay tuned for the second hour. Second hour coming up to talk about our reading habits in the digital age, some things that may surprise you about that. We'll take a break here for lunch provided by Apples and Oranges Fresh Market here on the Midday Show. So stay tuned for that, the news from NPR, and then our second hour.